From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
When you make a movie, you want to finish it.
Yes.
And I started on this movie in 1971 when I was 25, and I'm now finishing it in 2018 when I'm 72. So it's been quite a journey.
When Bourne Identity and Jurassic World producer Frank Marshall was just starting his career, he got an irresistible offer to work with Orson Welles on what would turn out to be the legendary director's last film. The Other Side of the Wind was still unfinished when Welles died in 1985, but Marshall was determined to see the job through. Marshall and fellow producer Philip Rimsha tell us how the quest to get this quirky film released involved the Shah of Iran's brother-in-law, Napoleonic law, and an Indiegogo campaign that failed but succeeded in getting some attention from Netflix. But first on the News Banter, speaking of Netflix, stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Netflix finally cracked. Netflix has made some grudging concessions to give some movies a theatrical run for those who want to see them in theaters, but it has to be the same day that these movies drop on Netflix until now. They have wanted desperately to get into the awards race. Guess what? A lot of people in the movie business don't like really want to give an Academy Award or even a lot of nominations to a company that has been seen as attempting to assassinate theaters. So it has been a tough battle for them. They've given this to three movies. Now they're giving them a short, exclusive theatrical run. Big concession for Netflix. Roma by Alfonso Cuarón, which is a Best Picture contender, or should be, is probably the primary reason.
Yeah, and you know, I think they're doing this to counter this narrative in Hollywood, which I think was best put by Steven Spielberg, where he said, if it plays on Netflix, it's a TV movie. It should win an Emmy, not an Oscar. Movies are in theaters. And until now, Netflix has always been steadfast that it's going to be on Netflix the same day. Now they're going to give this small 2-3 week window of exclusivity to theaters, few theaters, for these big movies. And, you know, it is a big concession from Netflix, but it opens up a can of worms for them. Yes, I think it will help with some Academy members, but it raises the question of what movies get this theatrical release now. And every filmmaker in Hollywood that's working with Netflix, and that's some big names like Michael Bay and Guillermo del Toro and these filmmakers that are used to getting huge theatrical pushes, are probably going to start demanding them.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a problem. And I also think that Cuarón, especially if the movie doesn't do as well as he might want in the awards race, I think this is just not going to seem that generous to him. I mean, this is 50 theaters around the world here in this country, New York and L.A. I mean, I think that having seen the movie, I would say make every effort to see it on a big screen. If you can't get to a theater because you live in Chicago or somewhere smaller, then, you know, find your friend with the biggest TV and go watch it there. But I think Cuarón, you know, I just feel like it may have sounded good at the time. And this is an art house movie, to be clear. But I think at a certain point, it's just going to be like, you know what? I'm not happy. These guys still want their movies on the big screen.
And the theater owners themselves are not happy either. They released a big statement after Netflix announced this saying this was a token release and it's not really going to budge them. Most of the big chains still ban Netflix movies because they don't adhere to a longer 3-month window of exclusivity that the major studios do. So I don't know that the exhibition side of the business is happy about this either.
Now let me turn to what will probably not be in the Best Picture race, but maybe in Best Actor, Bohemian Rhapsody. Bryan Singer's movie, he was fired with a couple of weeks left to shoot. Bad behavior. Basically walked away from the set, which is not the first time he has behaved in a troublesome manner. And the question for many people is, why would you give him another shot? We tried to answer that this week in an article in The Hollywood Reporter. Despite all of these problems, this movie looks like it will open really well.
Yeah, it's a movie that cost about $55 million, according to your reporting, and will probably open to about $30, $35 in the U.S., which is pretty good. But it really does obscure this whole backstory of Bryan Singer on this movie, because this is a guy who has had a notorious reputation throughout his career. Forget his personal behavior, which has also come under scrutiny via some lawsuits alleging sexual abuse and things like that. This is specific to what he does on the set. And Fox knew exactly what had happened in the past. He goes MIA. He has these bizarre bouts of anger and would get in fights with people and would kind of just be a general menace on the set. And they hired him anyway. And it gets to this question of, you know, in this Me Too era and Time's Up era, are studios going to start reevaluating some of these decisions that they've made in the past where they give kind of a blank check and leeway to these auteur type people that they will keep hiring despite bad behavior? And I don't know if those kinds of people are going to get the benefit of the doubt anymore.
Well, certainly in Bryan Singer's case, you know, these movies have worked less and less well until now. But, and I know from my reporting very much that Fox would like me to say, he came attached to this movie. He won over the confidence of the surviving members of Queen, and therefore he was in before, you know, Fox even got involved. So their decision was to take the movie with him or not, and they felt that it was a passion project and maybe this time would be different. It wasn't. They admonished him sternly, no bad behavior, no nonsense. The nonsense started right away, and I know at least one of the people involved with the making of the film now says it was not worth it in this case, so we'll see. I mean, he's already supposedly being pitched around for another film, Red Sonja, which may or may not happen, but as you say, some of these people survive, you know, behaving horribly and not even being successful, which in Hollywood, you know, will lead to a lot of forgiveness. Let me turn to another piece that my colleague Scott Johnson did. It's a really troubling piece. It's about injuries and death in the stunt community on sets. Because of this content boom, companies are rushing, using people who are not prepared and who are not seasoned. Being a stunt person obviously involves enormous risk, and we've had a rash of disasters and tragedies that appear to be due to complete lack of proper preparation and vetting.
Yeah, and it gets to this question of the impact of the content boom that we're currently seeing in Hollywood. You know, with 500 television shows and Netflix greenlighting 80 movies a year, there is a golden age of content going on right now. But one of the dark sides of this is that it's stretching these communities of specific craftspeople that have made the industry go for, you know, 100 years now, and one of them is stunt people. And the people that our colleague Scott talked to said there's just not enough qualified stunt people available to service all of these productions. So what ends up happening is corners are cut. People are brought in with no experience. There's a horrifying story of what happened on Deadpool 2, where a stunt person who had never done a stunt before, this person was a driver previously, and the first stunt she did was her last because she died, and there was a horrifying crash driving a motorcycle, and she was inexperienced. And this is the kind of thing that stunt people are talking about in the community, because it's going to happen more often unless actions are taken.
Absolutely. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The finally finished Orson Welles film, The Other Side of the Wind, follows an aging Hollywood director trying to boost his flagging career by making a flashy movie called The Other Side of the Wind. John Huston plays the lead, Jake Hannaford, a character who bears a certain resemblance to Welles. En route to a 70th birthday party at his ranch, Hannaford is hounded by slavish movie journalists, while his filmmaking protege, Brooks Otterlake, played by Peter Bogdanovich, tries to run interference.
Fine, rolling. Hello, hello, hello. Okay, I'm ready to go.
Just go right ahead and talk, Mr. Hannaford. Don't mind us.
I'll go first.
Mr. Hannaford, is the camera eye a reflection of reality, or is reality a reflection of the camera eye? Or is the camera merely a phallus?
I want a drink.
You heard him. Let's get it out here.
The Other Side of the Wind was troubled from day one. Welles was constantly running out of money, but famous writers, actors, and directors clamored to get involved. Welles worked on the film on and off for 6 years in the early 70s, but never finished it before his death in 1985. Bourne Identity and Indiana Jones producer Frank Marshall worked on the project as a young production assistant and long wanted to finish it, but the challenges were daunting. Finally, he teamed up with producer Philip Rimsha and got the job done. Frank, not only did you work on, and I think you have a cameo in this movie.
I have several.
You have several.
Yeah, I have more credits on this movie than any other movie I've done.
This would be an end credits drinking game every single time you see Frank Marshall.
Drink.
Take a drink.
I know Frank, and he pours a stiff drink, I can tell you from personal
Thank you.
Experience.
Still do.
Yeah. So, at what point did you decide you wanted to finish this thing? You were talking about something 1975.
Well, yes. Right. I mean, you know, when you make a movie, you want to finish it.
Yes.
And I started on this movie in 1971 when I was 25. And I'm now finishing it in 2018 when I'm 72. So it's been quite a journey.
That is a long journey.
You know, I went down to Arizona with Polly Platt.
Orson, oh, my goodness, Polly Platt.
Polly Platt.
The late, wonderful production
fabulous,
designer.
Yeah, wonderful production designer, writer, producer. And we arrived at this house in Carefree, Arizona, and there was Orson Welles and Gary Graver, who was the cameraman, and a couple of other people, and we lived in this house, and we started making this movie. Orson had already worked for a year on the movie, and sporadically for the next 6 or 5 years after that, we shot at various times, every time he got a little money. And then he pretty much finished shooting in 1976, and then was trying to cut it together and do post-production on it until he passed away in 85.
So, Frank, at that point, you're 25. Like, you want to work in the movies? You have worked in the movies?
I had worked on two movies, Targets, both with Peter Bogdanovich and Polly Platt, who were married. We had just finished Last Picture Show, and we had some months off between Last Picture Show and What's Up, Doc? And Orson had called and said, come on down to Polly, and she said, why don't you go with me? So I said, yeah, absolutely.
Were you like enough of a movie geek to be like, Orson Welles, oh my God.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the guy who made Citizen Kane, who made Touch of Evil, you know, Ambersons, and he was like a god. I mean, this, you know, if you were in, took any film school classes, Citizen Kane was the movie.
Right.
So to actually get to meet him and then work with him, it was, of course.
So I don't know, where was he at this point of his life?
He had been, at that point, abroad for about a decade. So he was in exile, working on various projects in Europe. I mean, he had, just before this, I believe he was in France.
And he had done F for Fake.
Yeah, Orson had been, he started shooting The Other Side of the Wind. He was working for the BBC on something, then was commissioned to do F for Fake. And a lot of, I guess, his takeaway, kind of reworking, shaping some documentary footage into an essay film. But through, by cutting a doc, he found the rhythm and the editing style that he ultimately then used for The Other Side of the Wind.
So you seem to be quite an Orson Welles fan.
I think I became an Orson Welles fan through the process.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because Philip became involved with me. Well, you heard about the project, what, 10 years ago?
About 10 years ago.
And then came to me about 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. Because I had been trying to finish the film since Gary Graver passed away and while Gary was still alive, who was a cinematographer.
You had never stopped trying to finish
Never stopped
film.
Trying.
And
basically getting somebody to put the money up. And people were coming from every which way, and they had deals, and there were Canadians, and there were people here, and there were people all over the world who would call and get involved until they found out that there was a chain of title that nobody could figure out, and there were three different people you had to get the rights from, and so it was so complicated. So when I first met Philip, which was at the Telluride Film Festival, I was wary. I was like, you know, here's another person coming to me mm-hmm. saying they can get the rights, but he had been working in Europe, and he had actually been doing real work on the rights, and after I spoke to him, we met a couple of times, I realized he was the real deal.
So how did you get involved in that?
I just was told that this project existed in its unfinished form, and I couldn't believe it. You know, this is Orson Welles. So I found out that the rights were available, which obviously was very complicated. But
what were you doing in your life at that point?
I was producing. I was just starting out. I just set up a production company. And, you know, this was something that was very tantalizing to my partners at the time. I said, I think this is something we should look into. And it took a long time for them to support this because it was a long shot. People tried and failed for 30, 40 years. And I said, well, let me first invest some time before we invest some money and really kind of do the due diligence, figure out how the IP works, why the rights were tangled in France specifically. So slowly but surely, I just started to make progress on trying to figure out what the court order in France was, why it was there, who were the parties
was
that...
Was the court order what, freezing everything?
Freezing the negative. Mm-hmm. So there were three parties who the court acknowledged had some share of the rights without really announcing who owned which percentage.
Right.
They simply said, unless all three of you sign off, nobody can have access to the negative. And it was complicated because it was Orson's mistress, who was the co-author of the script.
And is in the movie.
Also in the movie.
She's also in the movie. And Orson willed away his rights to the film to her. Yet, because the negative was in France, which operates under Napoleonic law, you have a split.
This is, I believe, is this the first mention of Napoleonic law? I think so.
Good.
On our show.
We so like to have, be first. Yeah.
So you have draw more, I'll draw artiste. But what it says is that you can't will away your blood. So the only country
you can't
in the
will away your blood.
Correct. So you. So
I wasn't planning
to. Orson had willed the rights to the movie to Oya.
Yeah, his creative rights. Which in France were really with his daughter who managed the estate.
Okay, so the daughter has a share, the mistress has a share.
Yes,
and
then the financier, who was the brother-in-law of the Shah of Iran.
Right, got to have him in there
exactly.
Because otherwise...
Of course.
How is it fun?
It's
yeah.
Too simple
right.
Otherwise. Who was operating through a French production company called Astra 4, and he came in and obviously in 79 then was subsequently overthrown by the Ayatollah.
I heard about that.
Yes. So, which added even more complexity to it. So what you had is these three parties who in France all had some share, who didn't have a healthy relationship.
Right.
But all were, you know, interested in some respect of maybe getting the film done, but they weren't communicating with each other. So you needed to mend those relationships and make sure that everybody aligned with whatever approach we would come up with in how to finish the film.
Well, and to be honest, everybody thought that there was a huge payday here for the
jokes
rights.
On them.
Which there wasn't.
Right.
You know, but so I had progressed to the point where I had one-third. Showtime had helped get one-third of the rights, which was the Astra 4 rights. Then when Philip came along, he said, well, I can get the other two.
You had already gone to France and charmed these people.
Yeah, so we already had the rights, the negative, without actually being able to withdraw it.
This negative, the entire negative, was in a lab, and we didn't know whether it was dust or whether it was preserved or there were nodes or it was just sealed up in all of these containers. In
so
a lab.
At some point you got to look, and I guess you were
we did. Well,
we
pooled our resources. We started working together and found out that we had been working against each other, which was kind of funny, for a couple of years. But now we were together, and eventually, long story short, we did get all three parties to agree.
Had you already tried the Indiegogo? Or
Yes. That was right
Frank
around...
Frank had, or both of you?
Both of us.
You did
yeah.
Both.
Yeah.
And you didn't get to the goal, I think.
Right? No, not even close.
We fell quite short. And but through that, in a way, because the phone call that I got from Netflix was 2 days after we finished the crowdfunding campaign. And they said, we've been paying attention. And we
waiting
loved
to see how much you might get out of
that. Well, but they said, we love how you handled it. That, you know, we were treating this not as any film. We were treating it as kind of as a, you know, an arts and culture event. And, you know, they started doing their due diligence. We, you know, had a few meetings and they said this is something that we're really interested in.
Coming up after a short break, Frank Marshall and Philip Rimsha tell us how they think Orson Welles would feel about his film being released on Netflix. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to producers Frank Marshall and Philip Rimsha about the long-languishing Orson Welles film, The Other Side of the Wind. After years of struggle, the film finally is finished and on Netflix now. The movie is part mockumentary, part film within a film, and part Hollywood satire. John Huston plays director Jake Hannaford, whose best days are behind him. He's trying and failing to finish a splashy, sex-filled drama that will get him back in the game. Meanwhile, his one-time protege, Brooks Otterlake, played by Peter Bogdanovich, is now a bona fide hitmaker. Much of the film is set at Hannaford's birthday party, where he's screening parts of his work in progress. But Otterlake is the one who's getting all the questions from a film critic played by Susan Strasberg, doing a thinly veiled impression of the legendary Pauline Kael.
This is Mr. Hannaford's night. Let's save the questions for him, huh? You two are very close, aren't you?
Yes, I'd like to ask you about that.
Why?
Come on, Otterlake. Why do you think you have to be as rude as he is?
As rude as you are, in print anyway.
I liked your last
one. Yeah, sure.
No, I know that it was repetitive, but it worked.
Yeah, well, she wasn't that kind to me in her review. Not that she did me too much harm. I mean, how much harm can you do to the third biggest grocer in movie history?
So this is a very quirky film.
Very quirky. Unique is the word that was used last night.
This is at the American Film Institute. You were at an event there,
right.
And it is unique. It doesn't read like a current movie at all, right? It feels very 70s.
Yeah, I mean, you know, mainly because everything is 70s in it.
It's
really 70s. One of the things I'm proud of is, or what I was really surprised about once we got all the negative, is that we didn't shoot anything. Orson had shot everything.
He'd have to shoot and reshoot some of this.
He shot and reshot and restaged.
100 hours of materials that we had to go through.
Jesus.
But this is his, he directed everything in the movie.
You know, it's a movie within a movie, and it's about this film that this Jake Hannaford is shooting, but at the same time, it is the film that Jake Hannaford is shooting. And I felt bad because I sympathized sort of with what was supposed to be a creepy studio executive looking at the footage of the film within the film. And I thought, I understand your distress because it's a very, like, not something you would see in a film, certainly today.
Well, this was his parody of Antonioni.
Yes.
And of Hollywood at the time. Yeah.
So many people have lost that point of reference completely,
yes.
You know.
But we thought that all of a sudden Orson really started enjoying making that film because he kept shooting it and shooting it.
Right.
You know, so it was fun because it wasn't his film. It was the director's within it. So he was wearing kind of a mask and doing it as another director. And I'm sure it was very freeing to do it that way. And this was something, and you know, it's the film is very unique within Orson's body of work, that the film within the film, because of how erotic it is. And Orson had a very puritanical approach to sex. So, and this was Oya Kodar's contribution. And
she put in the naked ladies.
Absolutely. Well, she naked herself.
She was committed.
Absolutely. Yes. And she was the one who always says, you know, I brought out the eroticism in Orson Welles. So, you know, so she very much is kind of a co-author of the film within the film.
So, Frank, I mean, I don't know, what was the hardest part about putting the thing together, aside from I assume having how many, 100 hours?
Well, it was like a little treasure hunt, and we didn't know what we were up against. Every day there'd be a new problem. It was a real problem-solving
from a technical experience. Standpoint.
Technical, yeah, right. Because once we got all the film and we knew we had everything, but there were no notes, there were no script notes, there were no slate numbers. And also, he would do things like give lines from the script from one character to another. And there were no notes on it, and suddenly we'd see somebody else saying the same line to somebody else.
You were like, wasn't that supposed to be?
Yeah, and then, you know, midway through what I call the real movie that we shot for a month in Carefree with everybody.
Carefree is actually a place, it sounds
yes,
like.
Yes, Carefree,
it's not a place,
Arizona.
But it's a place, yeah. Ironically named in this case.
But Rich Little was playing a part.
I read that.
He just disappeared
one day, and nobody seems to know exactly
why. The last day,
right,
on a Sunday, and we had a big scene at the Dick Van Dyke studio, which for some reason was also in Carefree, Arizona. two stages that we built a set on. We had all these extras come out from Scottsdale, and Rich went off because he had a commitment in Vegas on
Tuesday. I've read a little bit about this.
His version is different than my version.
Or did he leave? But whatever, he wasn't there anymore.
He left. Whatever happened, he left. So we didn't shoot that night, and we shut down, and it was really our last day. And the next story is a Peter Bogdanovich story where what happened was that Peter called Orson and said, how are you doing? He said, terrible. And he said, why? He said, well, Rich Little left before we were done with him.
Right, right.
Peter said, well, what are you going to do? And Orson said, I don't know. And Peter said, well, why don't I play it? And Orson said, well, you're playing that other part. And Peter said, well, you can reshoot that. And he said, well, I never thought of that. Would you do that? And Peter said, yes. And Peter
and
came
down. And obviously the character was a young filmmaker who had three hits behind him and did impressions. And that is exactly who Peter was
who
at
Peter
the time.
Was.
So it's
it
was a little freaky for me.
I did not know Peter Bogdanovich did impressions.
Yes. Oh, he's very famous for that.
He is?
Yes. Oh, you should just ask him to do Jimmy Stewart or Henry Fonda or
Hitchcock.
Hitchcock or Orson.
That was a bit of luck, but they just had to shoot the... So when you put it together, it was just like you're trying to figure out where this person wanted this film to go.
We had an annotated cutting script, but there wasn't any one manifesto because he intended to finish this himself.
And
so
he
there
cut
wasn't...
several sequences, so... We kind of had an idea of the movie within the movie, and then the frame around
it. You can get from here to
it.
There, he's cut that part.
And then we have assemblies, kind of looser things, where you know which takes he liked. So so you have a blueprint, and then it just becomes the process of trying to figure out what did he intend to do with this, that, and the other. And that's when you really have to dig deep into it and kind of try to get in his head.
And that's maybe a little daunting, like what would Orson do?
Yeah, but, it kind of made sense.
But when we had the dailies to some of these things, you can hear Orson giving direction and knowing what he was going for. So here's Orson from The Great Beyond telling you exactly what he's looking for and what he wants.
So when you finally pull this thing together, you don't get to go to Cannes because they have that thing with Netflix where they want movies to play for a rather long time in theaters, which Netflix was not even close to accommodating, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this feels like it was made to be played at Cannes.
Yeah, that was our original intention. Yeah. I mean, Orson's revered in France, and we were racing to be ready. I'm not sure we would have been ready because we kept running into problems in post along the way, technical problems, sound picture, all those kind of things matching.
But it was disappointing because we knew what they had planned for us and it would have been beautiful. But, then we were able to use that additional time that we had. We ended up actually working for another probably month after that. We obviously slowed things down and kind of reopened and kind of, took our time with sound and then eventually ended up in Venice and Telluride.
How do you think Orson Welles would feel about being streaming on Netflix?
He has the opportunity for this film to be seen by more viewers than all of his other films combined.
But it won't get like a wide theatrical release, obviously.
Well, I think it's some of his films at that point, F for Fake, didn't have a theatrical release up until 2 years after, and it was tiny. So I think by comparison...
We think he would want people to see his movie.
Take the win.
Take
the posthumous win. Yeah. Now, Frank, you have a few things going on, a few little movies.
Yes, a couple.
Does anything from this experience with Orson Welles ever inform, do you think, Orson this or Orson that ever?
Well, I think, there are no boundaries. He never gave up. He was always inventive. He liked to say that there are these little accidents that happen along the way as you're shooting, and you take advantage of those, and that's a wonderful thing in a movie. And so rather than seeing something go wrong and being upset about it, sometimes it leads to something better than what you were thinking. It's what I say about Steven. A lot of times when he's put in a box...
Spielberg, just to make clear. Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Spielberg. When he's put in a box, he gets more creative.
Right.
And I think that's what I learned from Orson. And that just keeps me going on the directing side and on the producing side. Never give up.
Frank Marshall and Philip Rimsha are the producers and two of the rescuers, key rescuers of Orson Welles' final film, The Other Side of the Wind. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith and additional help this week from Phil Richards. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.